This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
News about climate-driven migration continues to pour in, even in the last few days. On December 2nd, the charity group Oxfam released their new report. Oxfam says, quote, climate-fueled disasters were the number one driver of internal displacement over the last decade, forcing an estimated 20 million people a year from their homes. Today, you are seven times more likely to be internally displaced by cyclones, floods, and wildfires than by earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, and three times more likely than by conflict, end quote. So most of the climate victims will not head for America or Europe. They will stay within their own country or region. And for that, we have a report from the World Bank titled Groundswell, Preparing for Internal Climate Migration. One of the co-authors of that report is Dr. Alex DeSherbinen. Alex is the Associate Director for Science Applications at the International Earth Science Information Network, that is located at the Earth Institute of Columbia University in Palisades, New York. Alex holds a position with NASA as well, the International Science Council, and a long list of groups working with disaster preparedness and the future, right up to a visiting appointment with the Chinese Academy of Sciences. From New York City, Alex DeSherbinen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be with you, Alex. Thank you for inviting me.
What will you present at the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco this year?
It will be the results of some modeling work that myself, colleagues at the World Bank, and colleague Brian Jones at City University of New York Institute for Demographic Research were involved in, released a report in 2018 called Groundswell, Preparing for Internal Climate Migration. The session itself is all about modeling the future of climate migration or climate-induced migration, and so this will be one of a number of papers that address that topic.
So we know Donald Trump put the spotlight on immigration, and Latin American immigrants seeking a new life in the United States are fleeing poverty and gang violence and all that, but Alex, are there credible climate drivers pushing people north to the border as well?
The evidence is mixed, but there is evidence that the what they call the midsummer dry spell is lengthening and growing more intense. This is a critical period during the growing season in Central America for subsistence crops. And so there's a dry corridor in Guatemala stretching down into Honduras and parts of El Salvador, and that midsummer dry season, or they call it canicula, is growing longer and more severe. There are also reports that certain types of diseases are attacking coffee plants that would be, you know, are a signal that perhaps rising temperatures or higher humidity levels or combinations thereof may be making certain types of pest infestations more prevalent. So the agricultural picture in Central America is not good, but as you mentioned, it is one of many factors that are contributing to people perhaps making decisions about whether or not staying is a viable option.
Yeah, when I think about internal climate-enhanced migration, I really focus on two cases. There were the millions of farmers in Syria pushed towards cities and unrest by a long-standing drought in the early 2000s, and then there are large numbers of people flooded out of New Orleans by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Those Katrina refugees went everywhere, Houston, Denver, Nashville, all over the place, and I think there's a story there that still hasn't been told. But did American cases come up in your study for the World Bank?
Not really, because the bank, as a development institution, is focused on low and medium-income countries, so the U.S. does not qualify. I'm certainly aware of research that's been conducted in the U.S., and there's been some excellent longitudinal studies that have captured some of the changes in well-being among those who migrated out of New Orleans owing to Katrina and who stayed in their destination areas. So it's a mixed picture. Some people have done better. Certainly they've lost a certain social and cultural richness, but you know, in some cases, they've actually done economically, objectively better than if they had stayed.
That's interesting because that sort of mirrors what we were told by Vietnam expert David Brown. He talked about environmental refugees coming out of the Mekong Delta of Vietnam as the salt water kind of invades there. But he says they're not doing too bad. Some of them went to the newly industrialized cities. There were jobs for them there. So it's not always a bleak picture when people get displaced, even though it hurts them surely at the time.
Sure. You know, a few years ago I went to the Mekong because when you study climate migration, there's a few ground zeros for where people consider the worst impacts may happen, and the Mekong is certainly one of those. And the government instituted a policy called Living with Floods. They started building dikes, moved people away from the main stem of the Mekong River to these dikes, and then built roads to the dikes. Well, gee whiz, the people decided that maybe staying in one place wasn't such a great option now that they had a road and they had the infrastructure to get to the city. Many of them either leave the government provisioned house empty, or they rent it out and they move to the cities, or they move back and forth. One thing that we know is that rural people in all over the world figure things out, and they're just like any other human being. If there's some economic advantage in moving, they'll do so. If there's some economic advantage in spreading their eggs among multiple baskets and having part of the year in an urban area and part of the year in a rural area, they will do so.
Yes, the people of Bangladesh have also been pretty innovative when it comes to handling the fact that storms keep pushing them back from the sea. I've heard of floating gardens and things like that. But really, over time, at least tens of millions of people are going to have to leave the coasts of Bangladesh. And where are they going to go? Is there any place for them to go?
That's a really good question. So with our World Bank study, we in fact included Bangladesh because that's another, well, I hate to use the phrase hotspot or canary in the coal mine, and everybody who's looking at issues around sea level rise and migration, many people are focusing on Bangladesh and what might happen in the Ganges-Brahmaputra Delta. Yes, indeed, I think there will be a certain amount of forced displacement out of the delta. Cities are already pretty crowded there. Many of them are already low-lying as well. Our modeling essentially said there may be an increase in the number of people moving along the main stem of the Ganges River, sort of to the northwest of the country. But I had to ask the same question, is that even feasible given the density of settlement in many parts of Bangladesh? There's very little unclaimed land that can be turned to, you know, productive purposes.
And they're not going to be welcomed by their neighboring countries, certainly not by India.
No, there's been a lot of tensions along the border, and there's also an additional factor in that Narmada Dam, which traps a certain amount of sediment and certainly some of the flows, has exacerbated some of the flooding, and also what they call the distributaries that distribute the floods. Many of them have become silted up because they're not getting as much water as they used to. So if you reduce the fresh water coming in and increase the pressure of salt water moving upward, then the result will be increasing soil salinization. There's little doubt about that.
Now, when we see news videos of crowded boats sadly sinking in the Mediterranean, most of the faces on board are dark. What do we know about the relationships of climate change to those millions trying to flee sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask. We were just finishing up a workshop on climate migration in West Africa over the last few days here at Columbia University, and we were privileged to have Jesse Rabeau, who's a scholar at American University, and he actually traced one or two boats. There was at least one boat that went over and where many people from one particular region of Senegal were affected. Many of them, unfortunately, died. He went back to interview their relatives. One point he made was that there really was no significant climate trigger at all in the preceding 2 years prior to the tragedy that occurred in the Mediterranean. So this narrative of climate change driving the migrants coming across is a gross oversimplification. It doesn't mean that climate factors are not significant in some areas. We know that agriculture and the agricultural systems in much of West Africa and even in East Africa and the Horn are subsistence in nature mostly. They depend heavily on rain-fed agriculture, not irrigated agriculture. So as the rainfall goes up and down, it affects farmer yields. But at the end of the day, what he found was the most significant factor driving migration out of this particular region of Senegal was that young people did not feel they had any future in the village. And there was such a stigma attached to being the sort of the last man standing, as it were, in your village, that many of them chose the risk of a very real death to the high potential of a social death in the village, meaning they had no standing, no dignity, and no real way to prove themselves. It's sad. That is not necessarily the same dynamic pertaining in every community in West Africa. The cultures vary heavily, but that was an illustrative example of the fact that people often take desperate measures because they feel that this is really the only option remaining for them. We have to remember also that much of Africa has very high population growth rates, so land is becoming more fragmented. There's still, in general, abundance of land, but the fact is that it's low-input agriculture with very low productivity, and so unless it becomes intensified significantly, unless market access increases, unless farmers are paid a reasonable price for their produce, and those are a lot of what-ifs, people will, I think, have an inclination to look elsewhere. I'll add to that that there's been, in the last 15 to 20 years, obviously with social media and the potential for communication, you know, the image of the successful migrant who's made it in somewhere in Europe that gets beamed back to the village, even if that person has not really succeeded, but they're projecting an image of success, which is one of the beauties of social media, as we all know, people pick that up and then say, well, I'm going to try my hand. You know, the odds may be against me, but I'm going to just see if I get lucky here.
Thank you for that update and in-depth analysis on that. It is so complicated. The way I picture it, Alex, is that climate can be a factor, but then humans themselves are hugely changeable and tend to move around anyway all through history. So I think the climate sometimes can tip something that then grows much bigger than you would have expected. Syria's like that. The civil war and all of that was somewhat unexpected from a drought that happened earlier.
Yeah, and I think you need to look at the fact that, you know, the response by the government to that drought was simply insufficient. In fact, it was, from what I understand, a complete disregard of farmers' concerns, a longstanding and simmering discontent with the Assad regime, et cetera. So, yes, people are complicated. Humans have been moving from one place to another for all of human history. And climate has always been one of many factors driving that movement.
You know, we've seen populist calls to shut out migrants, to build walls, or even for hate. And we're only at the beginning of what could be a human tide driven in part by climate change. It's hard to see how this is going to work out without concentration camps or wars or killings. Are you more optimistic than that?
Well, yeah, I certainly hope that there's a recognition on the part of the global north that some of the responsibility for conditions in the global south is due to the past emissions of greenhouse gases, and that we actually do have the wherewithal and the resources to help our neighbors. You know, it's not so simple as opening up the borders. The real politic of migration is extremely complicated, and as you mentioned, the migrant flows to many countries do not look like the populations in those countries, although as there's more migrants, the populations in the destination countries do begin to look a bit more like that. But those who have the power, et cetera, are reticent. And so it needs to be a real, very real discussion and real debate. Will there be outright wars, genocides? Well, a bit hard to predict at this stage.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Alex de Scherbenen from the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and we're talking about climate-driven refugees in a hotter world. So the world media is focused on migration between countries and even between continents, but the World Bank report looked at internal migration due to climate change. How significant is that, Alex? What are the numbers?
Well, if you just look at total migration numbers, just strip out the climate aspect, but anyone who's moved, there's some ballpark figures that suggest there's roughly 750 to 770 million internal migrants globally. My guess is that maybe it's higher. I mean, I live in New York, but I grew up in Massachusetts. I'm essentially a migrant, right? So if you count all those people who moved from some, they're no longer living in their birthplace, it's probably much higher than that. But if you take a stricter definition and say within the last, 10 years and they had to move a certain distance, okay, maybe it's somewhere around 750 million. The best estimates of the number of international migrants is around 250 million. So that means you've got a 3-to-1 ratio of internal migrants to international. So that suggests to me, and that's one reason why in our work we focused on internal component, because the number of people moving internally will dwarf the numbers moving across borders. And obviously the smaller the country, there may be a higher propensity to move across borders. We're not denying there'll be some variation, but in general, people tend to move to opportunities within their boundaries, within their borders, because the cost of traversing boundaries or crossing borders, I should say, and dealing with immigration and other issues can be prohibitive for many people.
What countries are most at risk of internal climate migration?
Well, I mean, we mentioned already Bangladesh, Vietnam. So if you look at sea level rise, some of the largest or most demographically significant countries in terms of impacts would be there, as well as the Nile Delta of Egypt. The other countries largely are in sub-Saharan Africa because of the precarity of many ability to confront, you know, additional shocks. So many of them are kind of at the edge already in terms of their capacities, and they could be pushed well over the edge by additional climate shocks. You know, those are some of the major countries. Central America may also see some significant internal migration and external international as a result of climate impacts. There's projections that it will get significantly drier in many regions. And you already have the effect of periodic, fairly major tropical cyclones that come through. There's no one place in the world that you can point to and say this is going to be ground zero, but there'll be a lot of places with very different reasons for people moving.
Yeah, just a single storm can do it. Look at Puerto Rico. 100,000 Puerto Ricans left right after Maria struck. So how are national governments doing? Can you give us any examples where governments are aware of the problem of climate-induced migration and they're developing reasonable plans?
Well, Bangladesh would be one country where the government has taken this very seriously. They've developed early warning systems for cyclones so that people don't necessarily have to leave those areas until there's a risk, and then they move and then they can return. But it's greatly curtailed the loss of life. You know, they're developing and just addressing issues around saltwater intrusion in some regions. The government of Ethiopia is one of the countries where we worked a bit more intensively with the government, and the bank has some plans to foster more resilience in the dryland areas where livestock herding is prevalent. And that could potentially help accommodate more people, at least keep more people gainfully employed and not so prone to move to urban areas. So those are two examples of countries with, I think, fairly good amounts of foresight in terms of what may happen.
But it's possible governments could fall or go into social chaos or become so-called failed states due to the impacts of a shift in climate. And we're talking decades in the future, but it could happen.
Yeah, well, we all desire the crystal ball, but none of us are able to fully predict what may happen in certain circumstances. I mean, there's been some rather worrying reports, even recently in the New York Times, about India's water situation. I've been tracking that loosely. Between extreme heat, So temperature and heat waves that were record heat waves in the last 5 years, occasional droughts, but also sometimes extraordinary flooding. So this sort of seesawing between floods and then or stream rainfall and then drought conditions. None of this is desirable from agricultural perspective. And they're tapping their groundwater at record levels because of incentive systems that basically push larger farmers to run pumps continually. You know, that's one part of the world where unless they start managing their limited water resources better, you're going to see some significant issues. You know, China, I was going to mention, because in the context of large demographically significant countries, they're sort of study and contrast. So you asked earlier about which countries are preparing for migration. Well, in some ways, China isn't just preparing. They're already moving people. And they have one of the largest resettlement programs in the world. They have, obviously, the largest population in the world. And they're actively moving people in a program called environmental migration out of marginal environments like mountainous areas that are semi-arid, into valleys or oasis areas that have irrigation potential, into, you know, some people are being moved into urban or peri-urban areas. They are moving water, and, you know, massive levels through the South to North Water Transfer Project. This is a basic effort to move water out of the South where there's fewer people but a, you know, relative abundance of water resources towards the North where there are a lot of people but quite a bit of aridity, think about Beijing, and they are moving people out of the way, channelizing rivers and essentially preparing for, you know, preparing for a drier future. And you could say it's heavy-handed. It has a very strong top-down engineering focus, which is often characteristic of many big projects in China, but the U.S. has done a lot of that itself, so we certainly are not immune to that tendency. And the jury's out, but the preparedness measures may pay off in the long run as they start facing more erratic rainfall.
But scientists do occasionally try to look into the crystal ball, hopefully with decent models and a lot of other data. For example, in Chapter 2 of the World Bank report, Groundswell, you looked at climate change impacts on livelihoods and migration patterns through 2050. And can you just give us a snapshot of what is expected to change as we go through the next decades?
Sure. So the more traditional approach to looking at climate migration has been to use the raw climatic data, so changes in precipitation or temperature or potential evaporation, evapotranspiration. There are a number of metrics that have been used. What we wanted to do is look at the actual livelihood outcomes, or let's say outcomes to systems, productive systems that matter to people, rural people. So we projected forward using data from the Intersectoral Impact Model Intercomparison Project, or ISIMIP for short, and working with colleagues at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impacts Research, we looked at how crop production and water availability may affect migration in the future. The results, it varies by region. I mean, in broad brush terms, we found that some regions like Mexico and Central America and East Africa, that there was some movement towards highland areas that were not already extremely densely settled. So the model essentially suggested that people were moving to kind of higher, more temperate environments. There was migration out of the coastal zone in many areas and also in those areas that will become hotter, not necessarily drier, but when you increase the temperatures, you will also increase evaporation, evapotranspiration, and that will reduce soil moisture, which is an important variable for agriculture. You know, the models produced roughly what one might anticipate in these circumstances. And the numbers, you know, the bank wanted to produce a report with numbers because they felt that that would capture the attention of the media better. So we came up with numbers for three different regions in total. Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and South Asia, roughly at the high end, 143 million people. But that's under a pessimistic scenario with high emissions and high inequality. If you go into a scenario with lower emissions. So RCP 2.6 in the parlance of the IPCC, and a situation with a more equitable development scenario. Basically, the numbers go down to something like 60 to 70 million. One thing that, you know, to be clear, we did not somehow game the model to produce these results based on different emissions pathways. We simply ran the model, and this is what the model suggested, was that lower impact scenarios produce fewer migrants.
Well, I just have to insert this one sort of editorial comment. I mean, the World Bank, as a giant lending institution for development, funded the construction of coal plants in many countries, and those coal plants run for about 60 years. And so that's going to lead to more warming and more migration. And now it seems like the bank, can it steer investments and loans to mitigate the displacement of what could be up to 100 million people as Earth warms?
Yeah, you know, large multilateral investment agencies tend to have many different arms, many different facets. And so I'm sure they've made many investments that are, from a long-term perspective, not optimal. But there's also strong impetus to get electricity to more population, to larger populations, and, you know, raise more people out of poverty. And so I'm not defending the bank. I'm just saying that they often, different arms of the institution will do different things, and sometimes they're at cross purposes.
I know you work with a large number of institutions and you play various roles. Are there quickly any other looming problems or challenges you think we ought to know about?
You mean in the climate realm?
Yes.
Well, it's not hard to read headlines these days that suggest that things are going to rapidly get worse across the board. And whether it's increased wildfire risk, and that's not just the American West, much of Siberia was up in flames. We, of course, saw the fires that were largely due to land clearing in Brazil, but there have been periodic fire episodes in the Amazon due to just extremely dry weather. And these are, you know, often result in kind of positive feedback loops where increased fire results in more emissions, and we have the ocean acidification problem for many coastal populations. That's going to be increasingly important for livelihoods, not just, you know, global seafood production for the wealthy, but for those who really depend on it. So the bad news, you know, across many different sectors and areas, climate change tends to outweigh any potential bright rays of hope that come from, say, extending agriculture farther north into the northern latitudes on soils that, frankly, are just not terribly suitable for agriculture.
Yeah, as a Canadian who's been there, I can tell you the Canadian Shield and the acidic bogs up there with thin soil are not going to replace the rich, dark loam of the prairies. And we had 2 years of fire emergencies here in British Columbia, and our listeners in Australia know exactly what you were just talking about. I really appreciate the overview you've given us here, Alex. We wouldn't have gotten that without you. From the Earth Institute of Columbia University, we've been speaking with Dr. Alex de Sherbinen. And he co-authored the World Bank report Groundswell, Preparing for Internal Climate Migration. You can find out more and get the links to that report from my show blog at ecoshock.org. Alex, thank you for sharing your insight with us.
It's been a pleasure, Alex, and thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.